So I will repeat for the sake of the recording that we are reading Living by Vow by Shohaku Okamura, and we're reading part of a chapter on the Heart Sutra. That is chapter 6.
Which version?
She's going to pass out. And we usually, on Sundays we chant it with the Mokugyo, but we can just recite it out loud. So the Heart of Great Perfect Wisdom Sutra. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing Rajanaparamita, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself is form. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this. Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither rise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. Therefore, given emptiness, there is no form, no sensation, no perception, no formation, no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of sight, down to no realm of mind consciousness. There is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance, down to neither old age and death, nor extinction of old age and death, no suffering, no cause, no cessation, no wrath, no knowledge, and no attainment. With nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on Prajnaparamita. And thus the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. Far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. All Buddhas of past, present, and future rely on Prajnaparamita, and thereby attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. Therefore, know the Prajnaparamita as the great miraculous mantra, the great bright mantra, the supreme mantra, the incomparable mantra, which removes all suffering and is true, not false. Therefore, we proclaim the Prajnaparamita mantra, the mantra that says, Gate, Gate, Paragate, Parasamgate, Bodhisattva.
So, just to say a few words about the sutra, this is the most, probably the most widely recited Buddhist chant. It's recited in pretty much all Zen temples. So it's obviously been considered deeply significant by the Zen tradition. It's pretty dense and basically deals with the most profound teaching of Buddhism, which is that all things are empty of inherent, independent, enduring self-nature. That we tend to impute such a nature onto things and to ourselves, but that those things that's an illusion. And so in this, so the five aggregates are the form, sensation, perception, formation, and consciousness. Like we're just made up of those things. Those things come together, and then there's a person. So they're empty, and then there's this teaching that seeing the emptiness, which Avalokiteshvara does, relieves suffering. So you'd think maybe that seeing that emptiness would be disconcerting or depressing or overwhelming or something, but it actually relieves suffering. But then there's also the teaching that the form does not differ from emptiness, and Shohaku Okumura talks in the section we're going to read tonight about some of that. It goes down and it's like this list. All things are empty. It's not just, you know, certain things are empty. So there's no form, no sensation, perception, formation, and consciousness. So the aggregates of the body are empty. The senses are empty, the contact between the senses and the mind. But then, that's interesting, he goes into the next section. There is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance. And then it's dot, dot, dot. And that's actually, and down to neither old age and death. That's actually referring to the 12-fold chain of dependent origination, which is an ancient Buddhist teaching about how karma is generated, how all of this comes to be, how ignorance comes to be. Ignorance leads to this, leads to this, leads to this, and then I go, you know, up to old age and death, and back again. So that's taking one of those fundamental Buddhist teachings and saying, that's empty. And then down to, he said, nor extinction of old age and death. No suffering, no cause, no cessation, no path. So that's the Four Noble Truths. The first teaching of the Buddha. The fundamental, like, it's all what it's all about. Saying, when you really perceive reality directly, even those things are just skillful creations, in a sense. They're not. There's no inherent existence and truth independent of everything else. So then, with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajna paramita. Paramita is a perfection, and prajna is wisdom. And this, and it particularly refers to the wisdom of seeing that things are empty. So this, the bodhisattva relies on this perfection of seeing emptiness. And thus the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. So the Buddhas and bodhisattvas rely on this wisdom. And it's an extremely elusive concept, emptiness. And actually, it's not a concept. I mean, it is, obviously. We talk about it, we write about it, we talk about it in class. I mean, in that sense, it's a concept. But what it's referring to, what it's pointing to, is not a concept. It's an experience. It's the reality of our existence. That said, it's very easy to, if you start thinking about this philosophically, you just completely get tied in knots. So basically, if it all just starts to seem really just pointless and stupid and, you know, why would this relieve suffering, then it's too much in the head. So, we'll let Shohaku Okumura talk about it.
Page 164. Emptiness in practice. O Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They do not appear nor disappear, are neither tainted nor pure, do not increase nor decrease. This paragraph was discussed above in relationship to Narayana's sayings in...
I meant for that just to skip that sentence.
Okay.
Just go on from there. Yeah.
It refers not to something outside ourselves, but rather to the way we see things, the way we grasp things using our intellect. Nagarjuna says that our usual way of seeing and thinking is based on mental formations or thought constructions that he describes as meaningless argument. This is an important point in Mahayana philosophy that is difficult to understand. I will discuss it from the perspective of my own experience. Buddhist teachers from Shakyamuni Buddha to Narayana to Dogen Zenji address the reality of our life, the true form of all beings. The problem is that when we think about this reality, when we try to grasp it, we lose it. We live inside reality. We are never apart from it. And yet we almost always lose sight of it. To discuss something, we have to take a particular point of view. This is the problem.
A long time ago, I read a book on logic that included many famous paradoxes. One of the most interesting was a story about a king who told his retainers that no liar should be allowed into his kingdom. He built a barrier at the border. The guard asked everyone who wanted to enter the kingdom whether he was a liar or an honest person. Since everyone wanted to get into the country, they all said that they were not liars, except for one who admitted, "I am a liar." The guard didn't know what to do. If this person really was a liar, then his statement was true. He was telling the truth, and therefore he was not a liar. If he was not a liar, his statement was false, which meant he was a liar. Either way, there could be no conclusion. Our usual way of thought presents a similar paradox. It doesn't really fit reality, so we often make poor decisions. This story is an example of emptiness. Before we decide whether someone is a liar or an honest person, we have to define these terms. A liar is a person who tells lies, of course, and yet this is not enough. A liar is a person who always lies, and an honest person always tells the truth. This is the basic definition of a liar and an honest person. When we use these definitions, we should be consistent. A liar always lies. If a liar tells the truth, liar doesn't apply. But in reality, there is no one who always tells lies. We tell lies to deceive other people, but if we speak only lies, we cannot deceive anyone. If someone always lies, I'll know that the opposite of what he says is true. In fact, there is no one so honest he never tells a lie. If we think someone is weird, we don't say, "You are weird." We might say, "You are unique." No one speaks only lies or only the truth.
In reality, there are no liars and no completely honest people. Thinking based on such definitions is an example of a thought construction or meaningless argument. Such thinking misses the reality that we all lie to some degree. And yet, there are some really honest people, and there are some liars. As Buddhists, we have to try to avoid lying because it is one of our precepts. If we interpret the precept of not lying with strict logic, we cannot be Buddhists. We can never completely follow the Buddha's precept. So we have to inquire deeply into reality. This is not a matter of pure logic, but of our attitude. This is our way of life, the Buddhist truth, and the true form of human beings. In Buddhism, the true form of all beings, the reality of our lives, is not based on simple logic. The wisdom of seeing emptiness is to see both sides. There are no liars and no honest people, and yet we had tried to avoid lying. There are two sides, and to see things from both is prajna. Our thoughts, values, and attitudes are based on our work, education, and experiences. We must have some yardstick to live in society, but this yardstick is not absolute. I was born in Japan and grew up in Japanese society and cannot be completely free of a Japanese way of thinking and behaving. I don't think that I have to become American or that you should become Japanese. We have to understand that neither the American nor the Japanese way of thought is absolutely right. There is another way of thinking, of acting, of valuing things. It is the way of letting go of thought.
This is what we do in our zazen. We become flexible. We have to let go of our evaluations and discriminations so we cannot really connect with people from other traditions or cultures. In the past, there were separate cultures that didn't meet on a daily basis. Our modern world is becoming one society. Here in the United States, many different kinds of people live together. If we hold on to our yardsticks and negate other people's ways of doing things, we will all fight. We will feel that we have to eliminate those who don't agree with us, but when we let go of our way of thinking and become even a little bit free of our yardsticks, we have room to adapt to other ways of thinking. Our lives become broader and richer. The United States is the only foreign country I have lived in so far. Japan and America are special countries for me. My ideas about America have changed many times. I was born 3 years after World War II. My first memory of America is when I was about 4 or 5 years old, and I was told that my family lost all of its wealth when the Americans bombed Osaka in March 1945. My family had lived in the center of Osaka for 300 years, and they had accumulated some wealth. In one night, we lost everything. I remember the only thing we had after the bombing was a statue of the Buddha, quite a large one for a lay family to own. I heard that my family had a shrine for this statue. I never saw it, but it must have been a large building. I also knew that my uncle was killed during the war. In my mind, these memories created anger, hatred, and fear. In elementary school, I heard that Japan was very poor and survived only because of the help from America. America was a very prosperous country, while ours was very poor. America seemed like paradise, and we hoped to follow the American way. Then I had two completely different, almost opposite views of America. America had become something very positive, something we had to study as an ideal of a democracy, science, technology, and materialistic consumer culture.
My generation studied the American way of life, production, and system of values. Japan became much too American, almost more American than America. When I was a high school student during the Vietnam War, the Japanese mass media presented American imperialism as the enemy of humanity. This was another completely different idea. Later, when I studied history, I learned that the Japanese army did terrible things to China, Korea, Taiwan, and other Asian countries during World War II. My understanding deepened. Anger, hatred, and fear turned into a kind of sadness about humanity. All human beings have the same problems. America, Japan, all nations, and all individuals have the potential to do terrible things. To see things from different points of view is good. Finally, I came to America to live in 1975. I lived in Massachusetts for about 5 years and experienced the American way of life. I found that there are many kinds of people, and some are not so kind, just as in Japan. People smile, laugh, cry, and scream the same way in Japan and America. I think there's no big difference. To deepen our understanding, we must negate our concepts. When we negate our beliefs and preconceptions, We can see things from other points of view or a wider perspective. We should try to avoid grasping with our ready-made preconceptions or prejudices. If we open our hands and perceive things carefully, closely, then we can see other perspectives. This is the opening. This is an opening the hand of thought. This is what we do in our zazen.
This practice of letting go of thought enables us to see people and things with fresh eyes. Right now we have many flowers outside. When we see them, we think they are beautiful. But when we look closely at a flower, it is more than beautiful. It is something really wondrous. Why is this flower so beautiful? Why does this flower bloom like this? Why is it that I can appreciate this beauty? There is surprise when we encounter things with fresh eyes. When we see the flower without thinking this is beautiful or what is this flower called, we really meet the flower itself. When we see the flower without thinking, we find that our life, this body and mind, and the life of the flower are the same life. There is no separation. We can say, I am blooming there as a flower. To extinguish our views, to let go of thought or to negate our own way of thinking is not negative. It makes our life very vivid and dynamic.
To return to the passage, O Sariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They do not appear or disappear, are neither tainted nor pure, do not increase or decrease. If we read this carelessly, we may think dharma is somehow beyond appearance and disappearance, beyond taint and purity, or increase and decrease. We might assume there is something formless beyond phenomena, but the passage shouldn't be understood in this way. For example, this book stand was made in the past by someone using pieces of wood, and today it exists as a book stand. Someday it will break and disappear. This is a temporal form, a phenomenon. When we hear, since all dharmas are marked with emptiness, they do not appear or disappear, we might imagine there is something beyond the phenomenon, in this case, the book stand. We might believe this something is a phenomenon. Which does not either appear or disappear, something that is permanent. We imagine the something beyond form is the true nature of this tentative phenomenon, that to see this true nature of emptiness is enlightenment. In other words, we think emptiness is separate from form. This is not what is meant by the Heart Sutra. Emptiness is simply how form is. This book stand is itself emptiness. We should not seek emptiness beyond this concrete book stand. Neither tainted nor pure, do not increase or decrease, should be understood in the same way. This book stand is neither tainted nor pure. We should not think that there is something neither tainted nor pure that exists beyond this book stand. Some people think that enlightenment is to see and become one with something formless and permanent beyond concrete things which have form and are impermanent. But the Heart Sutra says, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. We should not look for emptiness beyond form. There is nothing beyond phenomena. Phenomena are emptiness.
And Genjo Koan?
Genjo
Koan. Genjo Koan? Dogen Zenji says, conveying oneself toward all things to carry out practice enlightenment is delusion. All things coming and carrying out practice enlightenment through the self is realization. Delusion and enlightenment depend on the relationship between ourselves and other beings. We cannot say this individual person is either enlightened or deluded because there is no person without relationship to others. Practice enlightenment is not some mysterious experience. It is as clear and obvious as everyday reality.
Thank you.
Genjal Koan continues, when the Dharma has not yet fully penetrated body and mind, one thinks one is already filled with it. When the Dharma fills body and mind, one thinks something is still lacking. When we are not filled completely with Dharma, we grasp ourselves as the center of the world. We think this self is an absolute person who can see things objectively and understand them as they are. This belief occupies some part of our being, so the Dharma cannot completely permeate this body and mind. Therefore, we have to empty ourselves. Then the Dharma suffuses us and starts to fill the Dharma itself. When the Dharma completely pervades this body and mind, we feel something is lacking. Our way of thinking, our yardstick, is not complete or absolute, so we feel inadequate. We search more deeply. This is prajna, to become free from our own yardstick and see things from a broader or deeper perspective. This is the wisdom that sees emptiness. There is nothing we can hold on to, nothing we can grasp. We open our hearts.
Dogen Zenji used an analogy. For example, when we sail a boat into the ocean beyond sight of land and our eyes scan the horizon in the four directions, it simply looks like a circle. No other shape appears. This great ocean, however, is neither round nor square. It has inexhaustible characteristics. To a fish, it looks like a palace. To a heavenly being, a jeweled necklace. To us, as far as our eyes can see, it looks like a circle. All the myriad things are like this. Within the dusty world and beyond, there are innumerable aspects and characteristics. We only see or grasp as far as the power of our eye of study and practice can see. When we listen to the reality of myriad things, we must know that there are inexhaustible characteristics in both ocean and mountains, and there are many other worlds in the four directions.
The ocean is not merely round. It has many other characteristics and aspects. In Buddhism, it is said that the heavenly beings see water as jewels. There are many ways to perceive a single thing. The ocean is just one example of the myriad things we encounter in our lives. All people and things exist in ways other than how we see them. The phrase Dogen Zenji uses is Sangaku Jenriki.
Good job.
Did that pretty quickly. Meaning the power of the eye attained through practice. We develop the ability to see things clearly, closely, and deeply through the practice of letting go of thought. In Dogen Zenji's writing, practice means zazen. This is a very concrete description of emptiness in our practice. According to Dogen Zenji, our practice of zazen is the practice of prajna that sees emptiness. Empty means ungraspable. We open our hand and see things from other perspectives by letting go of our own personal yardsticks. The Mahayana Buddhists who wrote the Prajnaparamita Sutras considered the Heart Sutra to be a sutra of transformation of the self. This is the way we transform ourselves, transform our way of life, enabling us to be flexible and see things without attachment. It is not mere insight or wisdom, but rather a practice. Practice in the form of zazen is the foundation of our life. But since we cannot sit 24 hours a day, we have to learn how to encounter all things in our daily lives. We have to learn about the self, about our body and our mind. We have to practice together with others. To live and practice together with all beings is the Bodhisattva way. This practice enriches our lives.
Is that stop?
Yeah.
Okay. Stop.
questions or comments? I don't know why, but I feel like I only comprehend about half of what was meant by that, and I feel really dumb because it's very plainly put out there, and I've understood some really complicated things, but it's almost like the simplicity of it makes it just slip right through.
No, you're not alone that.
Thank you. Like, the part I get is, you know, that whole thing about when you think you know, you don't know, and once you reach a certain level, you realize that you really need to be open so that you can start grasping things, and that you're just never going to know it all, that sort of thing. And to just, okay, that part I get. But the other part, it's like, it was like Greek almost. I don't know what happened.
I think if anyone here has a sense, like, oh, okay, then they're kind of missing the point. That session this last week, those who were there, remind me if I'm telling this story wrong, but one of the people giving the talk talked about, what was it, calling the maid? So the story is that there was a woman, she had a lover, and she was an aristocrat. And the lover would come through her window, and he would know that it was time to come when she was calling the maid. I'm not sure exactly why this follows, but he apparently, he's not calling the maid then refers to, well, what he meant by it was we study and expose ourselves to these teachings, and we don't really understand them necessarily, but there's a certain part of us that does, that resonates with them. I really don't see what that story has to do with that concept. Do you guys get it?
Yeah, it's like, it's not direct. It's not like what calling the maid.
Okay.
Sounds like.
Okay, so
something completely different.
Signal.
And it kind of calls something up in you, like the lover.
Okay. You know, in any case, he referred to this several more times than during the session. Just like this might be calling the maid as I share this, as we study this teaching. But it's essentially calling to some part of us. I mean, some part of us has a sense that something in there is true. Something in there sparks our curiosity, and it's worth talking about and studying and hearing, even though it can't be grasped.
I almost feel
because it'll come someday.
I almost feel like the point of all of these works of art, is what I would refer to them as, would be anti-logic. Training your mind to not think about things with logic, because if you do that, it's always going to be grasping, because to think logic requires you to work with symbols and various other concepts which we use to refer to reality, but it isn't actually reality. And so it's trying to get you to realize that as long as you're trying to think in terms of definitions, you're never really going to grasp onto it. So it tries to, like, convey the emotion or the feeling or the vision of the person at that moment, because that's the only way you can transmit that.
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of the Buddhist methods and teachings are trying to evoke an experience, and rather than, you know, explain to your head.
Yeah.
And that's why there's always a fine balance between, you know, making the practice seem accessible and relevant, something that's, you know, relevant to your daily life and something you can do every day, and something, yeah, you can do, and that kind of thing, and, like, balance between that and, I mean, I think the shortcoming, if you do too much of that, do you think that's it? This is just, you know, this is just meditating, feel a little bit more calm. And it's like, there's so much more than that, and so many more levels to it than that, that we call the maid periodically just to kind of stretch our brains a little bit, challenge ourselves.
So is it kind of saying don't get attached to the teachings themselves, but more just allow yourself to experience them rather than rote memorization and thinking that, oh, nobody better make fun of this when I talk to them about it or else, because it's not about that.
Right.
If you practice but lose your expectation for practice, it's the first step in losing your expectations for life, for people's behavior and such, that losing the judgment. So you just kind of sit.
That's why you because it is a practice, not a philosophy, and yet the teachings, you know, because then there are plenty of Zen practitioners and monks have said, well, you know, it's just about the practice then. What do we need all these teachings for? What are you chanting this sutra for? What are we, you know, what are we talking about that for? But then it's like, well, why do the teachings bother you? Like, you know, if your practice is so strong, then who cares? You know? So, like, I feel like the teachings, they form a context and container. They give some language and form to our profound, inexpressible spiritual experiences, so that when we have them and encounter them, we go, oh, that fits in there, and no. Like it, I feel like it's a certain kind of positive brainwashing.
Brain cleansing.
That you're just, even if we don't understand or we haven't fully actualized it ourselves, we're just putting it in there.
Experiencing spontaneity without needing to be spontaneous in a way.
If we just let it kind of sink in and don't worry about it, then we don't have to be that, have that conscious expectation trying to figure it out or something
right.
like that. It'd just be like, what about that?
That's how I look at it.
I'm like, whoa.
It makes me wonder if also it's like, say that there was a virus that killed only Buddhist, like it wiped out all of the teachers. But there was a teaching, it was like, meditate, and then, this is the really deep thing here. And then you have all these people who are like, meditating, like, this thing still doesn't make sense, I don't get it. But then, it clicks, like, oh, and it could almost, like, be a, I don't know, maybe a way.
Well, I mean, that's what when the Buddha died, I mean, according to the mythology, when he died, and his if you can imagine, I don't know, like a very, I don't know if he was charismatic, I'm assuming he was, not in a sleazy way, but in a, you know, impressive, like Dalai Lama kind of way, you know, that all his disciples, you know, experienced the spiritual liberation through his guidance, and now he's dying, and they're like, you know, what are we going to do? Especially the ones who were only partway on their path, and they hadn't, like, achieved liberation yet, and they're like, no, don't go. And he said, you don't need me anymore. You have my teaching. Mm-hmm. Which includes the practices. Which is, you know, that's different in the sense of from some religions where it wasn't about him. He wasn't necessary to your deliverance. So, yeah, emptiness.
What's that part about when the Dharma fills you, then you, then it's incomplete, and then, so when you, what did you say, when you don't have the Dharma, you think you have it, when you have it, you feel incomplete, and then you get into emptiness? What,
well, you, This interpretation probably doesn't reflect the full reality, but the way I understand that is like kind of like he was saying in the book, that when you don't have a glimmer of the Dharma, even if you may have angst in your life because you want this or you want that and you want to be happy or you want to whatever, there's still a sense that this being is all of it. This self is
the center.
Yeah, the real and self-contained in some way. It may want things, but it is complete unto itself in a certain way. Whereas when you open up to emptiness in the Dharma, you realize that, like, there's no real fixed boundary. There's no real thing that you can identify as yourself. Then you realize, like, you're actually part of everything. So you can never see all of it. You can never be all of it. You can never comprehend all of it. Something is lacking because, I mean, that lack is not necessarily something bad. It's actually something that keeps our minds open and causes us to see
it. Right,
like a flower, what they were talking about, how we observe the flower, we are one with the flower, but we can't really fully comprehend exactly, like, we can understand how a flower operates, but we're never really going to know.
We're always just have a view. And that's fine. I mean, after a while we get comfortable that, like, I just have this embodiment and this limited view. And I can be comfortable in that. I mean, as long as I realize it's a limited view, then there's no problem.
Kind of an odd way of looking at self, or trying to define self, but does self include those billion or so other living creatures that occupy your body with you? Or full organisms?
Actually, at the session this week, one of the talks that was saying, like, you know, what is you?
Microbiome, right. I think, certain using.
What is you? And notice if you're armed, it's paralyzed. And you're like, I cannot move my arm. Suddenly my arm is like something else. But as long as it's, like, under my control, it's part of me. So, like...
I heard this thing, someone told me there's this new study where they're transplanting fecal matter for stomach issues. And ended up helping people who had depression, because the organisms were somehow affecting
our
brain.
Our microbiome is much more complex than we realize, and our diet affects it.
Yeah.
Much more greatly.
It's
interesting that we are not only one single organism, we are the microbiome, I think is the term I saw recently. And what makes that up to affect our lives? So, what is self?
So, in a sense, we're working on becoming more aware of how we perceive ourselves, recognizing our sense of self, and when that comes up and we get defensive or we get attached. You know, getting more familiar with that. And then watching it carefully so we can see how sometimes it shifts and it's not as solid as we think. And just keep on step. So that's why, and also in the Gendro Koan, which we recited every day at session, and then we recited to happen to recite to him, and then he talked about it in this book. He talks about the study Buddhism is to study the self. Mm-hmm. then eventually to study the self is to forget the self. Eventually.
Right, we're a universe inside of ourselves experiencing a universe that we are, in a grand scheme, a part of. It's really beautiful. I look at that all the time, like, just seeing everybody, I'm like, I can see myself in you and everyone else and in the flower and in the bee. It's just the collective consciousness perpetually fascinates me.
Study self in the end is a study of delusion. The more you study and understand the delusion, the easier it is to not be deluded.
Sentient beings are deluded about enlightenment. Buddhas are enlightened about delusion.